If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have the distinct pleasure of speaking with Dr. Nicholas Sutton of the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies. Good morning, good day, and welcome to the program. So before we dive into your translations, why don't you tell us a bit about the center and your work there?
Okay. Well, the center itself is an academic institution that is affiliated to Oxford University as a whole. And much of the work that it carries out is academic publications, academic books, academic papers, academic research and translations. We've got specialists in a wide range of different fields of Hindu studies working on various projects there. And we're very fortunate that that we're able to pursue those lines of study there. And we also, I think when the University of Oxford students want to explore Indian culture, Indian religion, they come over to us and they study with the academic directors and other academics who are present there. We've got Gavin Flood, fortunately, as our academic director, and he teaches courses to Oxford University students. So it's a kind of affiliation, but we're not essentially part of the university. They use us when they need us, so to speak. But from my point of view, I've always been focused on what they call continuing education, which I like to think of as expanding Oxford beyond the walls of the university. There's criticisms, valid criticisms being levelled at Oxford University that it's excessively elitist and it has a very high proportion of people from wealthy backgrounds attending there, coming from fee-paying schools. So what we've always tried to do is to take the same standard of education that people would get from Oxford University and make it available to everyone. So for 10, 15 years now, I've been writing and teaching courses which are offered to anybody in the community who wants to study. There's no qualification that we demand apart from an interest. And also offer the courses, I think this is a big point, offer them at a price that is accessible to the vast majority of people, because if studying at Oxford University these days is a very, very expensive business. But we try and keep our costs down to a minimum for that same reason, to make it available to everyone. I would also say, and I'd like to make this point as well, that the focus of what we do at the Continuing Education Department is perhaps a little different from conventional academic study, in as much as I think in religious studies, the emphasis is on learning about religions, learning facts, figures, locations, cataloguing the ideas they offer, the different tendencies within them. Whereas we do all of that, and I would like to think up to the same standard as is done in the very best universities learn a huge amount about the religion, but we also, I think, try to facilitate going a step beyond that and thinking about learning from the ideas as well. And that's always been my primary motivation, that if we don't at least give the option to reflect on the wider significance of the ideas and material we consider, then we're not doing justice to the subject area. We're reducing it to something rather mundane and bland when it's just brimming over with richness and deep ideas that make all of us think about ourselves, our lives. And I always like to say, let's take a step beyond just learning about religion and think about what we can learn from them, not in a confessional sense where I say this is the truth, but just saying, look, showing an idea, have a look at this, what do you think about this, does this relate to the way you live your life? So I think that's what we offer, perhaps, which is a bit of a bonus. Some might think it's an intrusion, but I think most of the students who study with us very much appreciate that we do facilitate that taking a step beyond.
There are a number of fascinating threads in what you just said, at least as it pertains to my own path and my own interests. I've been teaching continuing studies at the University of Toronto. I finished the master's in 2010, and then I took this teaching job. I've had it for the last decade or so, and I sort of feel that this will be my last year there, I think, to sort of branch out and do something a bit different. But alongside the continuing studies, I've been teaching courses in the community in Toronto and also online courses. And the continuing studies at the University of Toronto, we have interested adults, interested undergrads who love the material, and it's sort of a passion to study it and delve in. Yet the sort of precipice upon which you stand or even venture over, I don't quite venture over in that setting, but in other settings, online courses, as I say, I may say to folks, well, what do you make of this, you know, in terms of life learning, you know, what is the value of this, right? And so it really, really resonates. And full disclosure on the air here, I came across the Oxford Center of Hindu Studies' continuing studies online courses just last week, and I was gobsmacked. I was floored that there was this treasure trove of Hindu studies content really accessible to anybody who can afford a reasonably priced course in the neighborhood of £100 or so, and therefore I contacted the center, and here we are interviewing more about the center rather than your publications, because I think it's I think there's I sense a real synergy between the people who listen to this podcast and the people who would benefit from the Oxford Center of Hindu Studies. Because what you've done is, when you put courses online, it really collapses geography. It really collapses time zones. And so could you tell us, and this is our first conversation, so we haven't really shared war stories, so to speak, but can you tell us a little bit about how this online venture started up and its mandate?
Well, it grew out of, as you were saying there, it grew out of face-to-face teaching. When we first started up, me and a couple of colleagues, two or three colleagues at Oxford, Anuradha, Rembert, friends and colleagues, we used to drive all around the country in my old Volkswagen, and we'd do classes at Hindu centres primarily. Not everybody was a Hindu who attended, but it was very much groups of Hindus. We did Swami Narayan Temple or the Brahmin Samaj community, and we'd we'd put on classes and discussion groups there, trying to again take the knowledge that we had and kind of share it, and I would have to say learn an enormous amount. When I was working for the Open University some years back, I made the point that when I teach within the community, I'm always listening and hearing and learning so much because, and I think, sorry, I'm going off subject a bit here, but I think it's an important point. When you pick up a book which says Introduction to Hinduism, yeah, it does give you ideas about Upanishads, Advaita, etc. But it doesn't give you that real insight into Hindus. It's introduction to Hinduism. It's not introduction to Hindus. And it was only when we started working within communities, and I think that really enriched my ability as a tutor. When I also worked at Nottingham University at that time as a lecturer, and I could then really fill out the material in the academic books with personal experience of interaction with the community. It got to the point where it was just logistically impossible. Driving all over the country, and just two or three of us, I'd go down to London from Birmingham to every Tuesday evening to give a class. And I think we were just exhausted at a personal level. I started to feel unwell. My health started to decline. And I think a lot of it was just because we were so inspired by the project that we pushed ourselves too far. And it was at that point we started to think, well, maybe we could do it online. And in some ways, it's not quite as good online as face-to-face interaction. But in some ways, it's really much better. And the groups that we've got, which can vary in size from 10 up to 70. I think Zoe in the Sanskrit course has got over 100 this time. But we manage. Sometimes we have to have two tutors rather than one. But they're spread right across the globe. So in a typical course, I have people in Australia, New Zealand, India, European countries, UK, of course, Canada, US, Latin America. I think that's a great thing as well, because we have discussion forums, and a lot of the time people from different parts of the world are sharing their own experiences. And particularly, I think, in the last month or so, when, you know, there's been such terrible difficulties with contact between individuals, I think people have appreciated the opportunity to just discuss things with like-minded people. So the program has really, since we went online, it's really expanded. I always had this idea in my head, you know, if we went online, and opened it up on a global basis, it might take off. But I had no idea that it would take off to the extent that it has. I think that's true.
It will continue to take off. I think we'll probably enter in some kind of partnership to promote the courses, which will be fantastic, I think, for listeners. And for those interested in learning about Hindu studies in a responsible, but in an enriched, lived, empathetic manner. You know, I've said to colleagues, really, there's two functions that you/the center, because I'm inferring that you are the lifeblood of the center. But there are two functions that you fulfill that I think are crucial for what we do. The first is that it certainly isn't the responsibility of a scholar of religion to engage the public. That certainly isn't the responsibility. Nevertheless, it's very much needed for what we do. And the Academy would be well served to systematically do so, whether by appointing or creating a position per department or half-time position to do so, or certainly leveraging those of us who are more public-facing, people-friendly, and all that. This is the second function, which I've struggled with for years. As an undergrad, throughout my grad school, I've struggled with this forever, because I fully respect and understand that the academic study of religion, it's not theology, it's not spiritual care. And yet, there have been so many conversations I've had with undergrads who left wishing they got more of a taste of the religion. And it's really only in going to a trip to a temple, mm-hmm, that they light up, because then they've not just read the sheet music, but they've heard the music, right? They've heard the instrument. And, you know, I'm a bit of an armchair ethnographer, so wherever I go, I talk to students. So last year, I had the good fortune of presenting at the annual conference for the European Association for the Study of Religion. It happened to be in Estonia. And there I was one morning just chatting with the student volunteers about their courses in the nature of religion, and obviously they're the keen students who are volunteering for this, and they're very bright. But the same malaise was echoed even in that context, that really it would be nice to have more immersion into the religious life. And of course, that is not, I don't think that is the responsibility of those who teach religion at the academy. Nevertheless, our students are leaving not fully nourished, and they need to get that somewhere, especially responsible citizens of the globe, I feel.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And you say it's not theology, but I don't know about in Canada, but in Britain, you can study religion as under the heading of theology. I mean, my first undergraduate degree, for geographical reasons, was in theology. I got a BA in theology, and then I went on and did my doctorate in Mahabharata. But I would have to say that I found studying theology more interesting and inspiring, even though it was Christianity, which wasn't really of any great interest to me. But the way it was studied was so much more interactive with the students. For example, I studied global poverty and religious responses to it. Even back in those days, we looked at environmental crisis, which I didn't find any of that when I did religious studies. I did religious studies at Bristol to start off with. And I do think that we have, as teachers of religion, if you like, or as tutors of religious studies, we have such a wonderful, fascinating, absorbing, beautiful subject area to explore, more perhaps than any other subject area. And I do think, to some extent, where the conventional approach is shortchanging students, and they do tend to go away disappointed from their studies. I think there's a historical context to that, is that the original founders of the discipline, if you like, Ninian Smart and others like him, they were anxious to get away from that comparative religion paradigm where everything was studied in relation to Christianity, and they wanted to establish a sort of neutral perspective where each religion spoke on its own terms. But I've been feeling for years now that that argument has been won. We don't need to be overly wary about Christian bias, and the real danger is now from secular bias, that people, I had a colleague at Oxford today, she said she'd left the university she worked in because she didn't want to teach religion in an environment with people who don't like religion. I think particularly perhaps with Hinduism, there is a mood of sort of criticism and even condemnation in it, which I believe is absolutely inappropriate. I've always regarded myself as an Englishman studying an Indian religion or Indian religions as very much of a guest in someone else's property, intellectual and spiritual property. I mean, we gave a paper on that about the Mahabharata, that we are invited guests into someone else, another community's intellectual and spiritual property. As a poem by W.B. Yeats says, "Let us tread softly for we tread on dreams." Don't say those things. If you're going to cause any offence to anyone, don't say it at all. One thing I've learned from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 17, when you write, when you speak, your words should never cause disturbance to others. They should be honest, they should be pleasing, and they should be beneficial. A harsh criticism of a religion does nobody any good, except perhaps where it's obviously contravening dharma. So I do think, I agree with you completely, we have to look for, and I've been saying this actually for 30 odd years now, we have to approach religion in such a way that it inspires, the study of religion, I mean, that it inspires, elevates, and above all, interests people. Because a lot of what the academic, I know from tutoring in universities, you say, read this academic paper on the subject, and the students come back and say, it's so boring, which is dreadful, really, because religion isn't boring. It really reflects on every aspect of our lives. It shouldn't be boring, and yet somehow it's been made boring, I think, a little bit. So another feature that I always is I insist on anyone works, no jargon, no overly academic language to impress your peers, no references to people like postmodernist writers who nobody's ever heard of, not nobody's ever heard of, but perhaps not many people have ever read. Just tell it in a way that is readily comprehensible, because again, so much, and you must have experienced this, so much academic writing is almost deliberately obfuscatory. Sorry, I've used that long word there, but it seems almost to obscure what is not a difficult meaning. There was an article I read in the Times Higher Education Supplement a few years ago, in which the author subtitled his article saying the best way to impress your peers is to write complete gobbledygook that no one can understand. And it's just kind of, why do that? We've got something so wonderful here, something like Gita. Whether you're a believer or not, it's still a really profound contribution to the wisdom of the world. So cherish it and give it in a way that people will derive the utmost benefit from it. That's my belief anyway.
Well, it's certainly refreshing and inspiring. Would you say that the courses, the online courses that you offer, are sort of in that vein?
I hope so. And I think they've become increasingly so as I've got older. I've perhaps bucked a trend as particularly since my health has declined over the last 6 years. I'm not as vigorous as I was, and perhaps more in contact with my own mortality, literally, at times. I think you start to look at what you write and what you do, and you ask that question, what's the value of what I'm doing? And yeah, sure, it's good to know about religion, but I think increasingly I've always tried to put that element into it of exploring the wider significance, the wider questions that these religious ideas promote. It's not preaching. It's really very much like a lot of Indian texts are. It's showing you, have a look at this. Have a look at Yudhishthira in Mahabharata. This is how he behaves here. What do you think about that? Oh, here's Bhima. Look at him. He's more aggressive. What do you think about that? How do the ideas interact? And encouraging people to reflect on the wider significance of people without preaching to them, but, you know, trying to draw out the full beauty and richness and depth of the material that we study. It's never at the expense of knowing about the material. And I would argue that when we write them, we know as much in terms of, you know, the content, etc. We have to have expertise in the content in order to base our in which to root our further exploration, but it's offering the opportunity to go that one step further, I suppose. That's what I'd say.
Well, it seems to me that that scholars of religion, you know, their primary function is to understand sort of the socio-cultural horizon or impetus for the text or the phenomenon. At the same time, that doesn't preclude folding in sort of the psycho-spiritual or the reasons why something lasts a millennia or two are not because of the generation in which it began.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
And so to do one well seems to do the other not so well. And to get them both right is quite difficult, because many people may wax poetically about the essence of the Gita and how it moves their being, but not be willing to concede that there was a compositional history over centuries and there's a framing project within the Mahabharata. And yet those who may be experts at understanding that as best as we can, that compositional history, may lose sight of the fact that this is soulful, that this is expansive, that I am time run on to annihilate worlds. Mm-hmm. If that doesn't give you the shivers of the burning bush, mm-hmm. like what will?
Yeah.
And so to get the two sides of our being sort of to cooperate, to engage religion in a way that is rigorous, academically responsible, but it certainly isn't our job at the academy necessarily to spiritually cater to our students, but it's definitely our job to not deny them that nourishment by reducing religion to the elements that we can empirically examine, because clearly it's more than the sum of its parts for those who are moved by it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not our job to spiritually cater for people. And sometimes you do feel that role, which is basically the guru role, being ascribed to you. And I would absolutely reject any suggestion that what we're doing is taking on the guru role. It's not what we're doing at all. But I do think that whilst we don't spiritually cater, the material that we explore can provide that spiritual catering, like the Upanishads, for example. And so if someone comes to us and asks, you know, this idea, this concept has been troubling me, you can then often say we're like an enthusiastic librarian. You can say, well, have a look at this over here. See this section, read this, explore this. What do you think about it? So it's not on a personal level spiritually catering, but it's allowing the material that we consider to do that catering, which is what it was originally designed to do, undoubtedly.
We shouldn't eclipse the light of that material or tradition so as to have our students leave more jaded. there's obviously a tremendous amount of synergy, it seems, between our way of viewing and sort of using religion. And it was only when I started teaching online and in person that I had the full range to point to some of the deeper applications and meanings of the text without going into the realm of esoteric training. Right, there's still plenty that one can do with an astute humanistic eye that's well outside of, you know, diksha or, you know, some sort of esoteric grappling with the text. You have produced translations of two very popular and seminal Hindu works, the Yoga Sutras and the Bhagavad Gita.
Mm-hmm.
Let's touch on both of them. Which one shall we talk about first?
Let's take the Yoga Sutras first. Go on.
So why there's no shortage of translations of the Yoga Sutras. And so what prompted you to translate it, and sort of what might one get from this translation that's not quite elsewhere?
What I tried to do with, sorry, I would never say that, and I mean there's some excellent works on the Yoga Sutras and which go in more depth than the one I did. A lot of people are interested in yoga at the moment, and a lot of people take that interest onto the Yoga Sutras. It's a really difficult text, both to translate and to comprehend, even when you've translated it. It's open to a range of different interpretations. And all I wanted to do was present a version of the Yoga Sutras that kind of made sense to people, that wasn't beset by these too much complexities. Now, I accept that in doing so, I may have diminished the full complexity of it, but what I try to do is read the sutras for myself, reflect on their meaning, and then just try and explain what I saw as the significance of them in a way that everybody could could understand. I would say with dealing with the Yoga Sutras, and I'm working on it again, actually, using a range of the traditional commentators from Vyas, Bhigyan, Bhikshu, Vachaspati Mishra, and I would say that the range of insights they offer is goes beyond what I included in that small volume. But what I think people have found useful in it is that they can take the Yoga Sutras and not read three or four pages and think, I haven't a clue where this is going, what this is all about. They can read it and find an explanation that makes sense and is relevant to their own practice. And that's what I'm doing. And it's the sort of task that you do and is never complete. It's ongoing. But I think as a first step, it is quite useful. And it's something that takes you beyond just the basic and sometimes erroneous reading of the Yoga Sutras and gives you the first step to gaining a higher understanding in a manner that's accessible to people of all backgrounds, academic or not, that they can take that first step along the road with it. And then there are some other excellent books. Edwin Bryant done a really comprehensive version in which he does draw on the commentators. And I'm trying to do something a little bit similar now in expanding on what I've done before. But what I would say with that, the book we've got is it's a decent first step, first point of entry into the Yoga Sutras in a form that people won't find off-putting or overly difficult, and yet at the same time does do to a significant extent justice to the complexity of the material included.
Well, it certainly is quite accessible, so that it's probably, it may well be the most accessible translation of the Yoga Sutras that I've come across. So I'll certainly be recommending it to folks who might just want to dip their toe into the tradition, or get a sense of the sutras without being bogged down by too much of the technical or esoteric content.
Yeah. I mean, you'll see with the translations, my translations are much longer than the wording of the Sanskrit sutras, because if you're just to straightforwardly translate it word by word, there's hardly any verbs in it, for one thing. That's the way sutras come. So in a sense, as a translator, you've got to kind of fill it out a little bit. And I've tried to do that in a way that makes sense. And I think in case of most sutras, it does work. Some, if I was to go back, I might change them a little bit now. But you always do that, don't you? When you've produced a book, you look back at it and say, oh, I'd have said that differently. But I agree. I think that that's what the aim was always, to give people a first step on their introduction from which they can, if they choose, go on to look at the more complex studies, the nuances of Sankhya philosophy that are there in the Yoga Sutras. Start off, give it a go. If it really grabs you, then there's plenty more you can go on to.
So tell us then about your process with the Bhagavad Gita, how that translation came about.
Easier. I remember years ago, there was a scholar you might have heard of, Fred Hardy. I don't know if you've come across his work, German scholar. And I was talking to him, must be 30, 40 years ago, up at Lancaster University. And as we were walking along, he said, you used the Gita. And I said, yeah. And he said, how do you find it? And I said, well, Sanskrit-wise, it's relatively easy. He said, yes, I don't mean that, though. He said, can you understand it? You can translate the Sanskrit words, but do you understand the meaning behind those words? And I think that's often a lot more difficult. And it's progressive as well. There's never a point at which you say, now I've got the Gita. Then you come back the next day and you read a verse and you think about this word, you think about that word, and you see again something more that you hadn't spotted before. So you never reach the end. But I feel very confident, actually, with working with the Gita, and I have, going through that, I made use of particularly the principal commentaries on it. I used Shankaracharya's commentary, I used Ramanujacharya's commentary, I used Madhvacharya's commentary. So really trying to express the meaning of the Gita from within the tradition rather than from external voices. I mean, it's really difficult, isn't it, translating? Because on the one hand, you want to be as literal as possible. But on the other hand, you've got to convey the meaning, and it's finding that balance. I think increasingly, as I was working on the Gita, I was finding that I wasn't translating all the Sanskrit words like Atman, Dharma, etc. You could say, I don't know, law for Dharma or something like that. But it doesn't really, you've already got preconceptions of what law is, and those preconceptions aren't what Dharma is. And likewise, soul, if you use the word soul for Atman, we've already got preconceptions of what soul means, which aren't the same as the meaning of Atman. So increasingly, I've tended to leave those words untranslated and allow the context of the discussion and, of course, the notes that I had to explain the full meaning of them. But I like that text that I produced on the Gita when I read it. You know, sometimes when you've written something a little while back and you read it back, you think, "Ooh, gosh." And then, but when I read that one, I like it, and I think, "Yeah, that's a decent piece of work that I did on that." And I think I know the Gita very well. I've been studying it for years, and I've been thinking about it for years, and I've read the commentaries, not just those three, but other commentaries, Madhusudan, Saraswati, etc. And I've got, I think, a decent insight into what the Gita is about and what Krishna is saying, and also perhaps the full significance of the Gita, because this probably struck you as well, but for me, the Gita is so fundamental to the development of Indian religion, in as much as it looks back to the wisdom of the Upanishads, and it quotes from the Upanishads quite often, you know, the idea of Advaita, essential unity of all existence, which comes from, but it also crucially looks forward into the development of Indian religion with its emphasis on bhakti, divine love, divine grace, compassion of the deity for us and his saving of us, etc., which you don't find in the Upanishad. So it's such an important text, and I've tried to definitely step back from the sampradayas. In the notes that I've given along with it, I've said this is how Shankaracharya reads the verse. By contrast, this is how Madhvacharya reads the verse. Sometimes I had a comment like, in this situation, Shankara's interpretation is closer to the overt meaning, but never say that any other reading of it is wrong, and allow the readers to think about the subtleties of its thought, because the Gita, in many ways, is a very subtle text, and the way that the language of the Gita is used is in Oxford a few weeks ago now, actually, and Julius Lipner was giving a talk on Krishna smiling. It says there, when Krishna began to give his talk, it says Prahasaniva, smiling a little bit. And a lot of times you can see in the Gita, Krishna's very clever in the way he juxtaposes words will have different meanings in close association with each other, and you can almost feel as you're reading it through the smile coming through here, untangle that one, etc. And also, for example, chapter 2 verse 19 of the Gita is the same as chapter 2 verse 19 of the Kutta Upanishad. Again, maybe that's another one, that's a coincidence perhaps, or maybe it's another of Krishna's little jokes that comes through there. So I feel very comfortable with the Gita, and I feel very satisfied with it, with what the version that's presented. I think it's very accessible. I think it's rooted in the tradition that owns it, and I think it's pretty effective at showing the range of ideas that the Gita is setting forward. That's given it a bit of two cookies.
It's no small accomplishment to translate the Gita in a way that you're comfortable. And just to give the listeners a sense, your translation is much more than a translation, insofar as it's a guided tour. Interspersed in the translated verses are key points, are key questions. Clearly, this translation is the result of somebody who's a teacher first. Seems to me.
Yeah, it's someone who walks quite a lot, actually, as well. I mean, every day I I go out and do my 2 miles, and a lot of the things that are in there, I'm sort of, if I use the word cogitating, I've got a kind of sometimes a word or a verse in mind and going over why is this said? Why does it follow that verse? How does it fit together? So a lot of it is a reflection of those thoughts, and then you go home, you read what Shankaracharya says and thinks, maybe that, and then you read someone else. So there's a whole kind of thought process that's gone in it. And I really, when I pose questions, they're the questions that have occurred in my mind as I've read it, and possibly the suggested answers. I haven't got all the answers, obviously, but they're possible answers to the conundrums that the text raises. And say it could be that this is meant, or it could be that that is meant. And again, it's that same process of showing people, have a look at this. What do you think about this? Or have a look at that. What do you think about that? And of course, at the end, Krishna says, Vimushaita Rashashena Yatechtisita Takaru. Think about it all very carefully and then do what you decide is best. So I think that's what I'm trying to facilitate, showing, have a look at this idea. Have a look at that idea. Have a look at the other ideas. Do they fit together? Why is this being said? Why is this being said there? And trying to, if you like, unravel the text in that way.
Well, the text exquisitely advances puzzle pieces,
yeah,
and perhaps a bit of instruction, and is emphatic in its imperative that it is your impetus to assemble the puzzle, and indeed it may be the puzzle of a lifetime or many.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's been it's an ongoing thing as well. You know, the more it never stops, because recently I've been working on Shaivism, which I had some knowledge of before, but never gone into the same amount of detail. And interesting, again, when you read the writing of the Shaiva Acharyas, how they're raising the same questions. And in some cases, they're coming up with the same answers as the Gita. And you find kind of lines of congruence like that, which again raise more questions. So that's very pleasing as well, because it suggests that the questions that have been posed aren't specific to the teachings of the Gita alone, but they're universal questions that all of humanity faces throughout history. So I'm still expanding my knowledge of the Gita, but I do feel that one I felt like I'd managed to, you know, do that primary task of taking what is quite a set of complex ideas and presenting them, doing justice to the fullness and richness of those ideas, but discussing them in a manner that anybody could come along to and find that they make sense, not obfuscated in any way.
Well, a running theme of this interview is it appears to be a running theme of both your life and work and the mandate of New Books in Hindu Studies, and indeed the New Books Network at large. It's a consortium of about 85 subject-specific, public-facing author interview podcasts. And one of the core values is sort of the democratization of knowledge, or to render accessible. And so I find it fascinating that you found yourself in not just an ivory tower, but perhaps an ivory tower slightly more cloistered and taller than most. And nevertheless, perhaps because of that setting, you have endeavored to make accessible an Oxford education in some way, shape, or form, at least where it comes to understanding this thing called Hinduism. And now that thrust is available online through I'm sure close to a couple dozen courses fully built out, which is staggering to me, because the courses that I taught were always synchronic. I plan to build out full courses at some point, but really you need sort of a steady audience or an institutional setting to make that thrive. And for me, it's like the work is already done in these courses. It's already done. No. I mean, the work is done for, there's plenty that I could teach on, obviously, plenty else. But I mean, the work is already done. The teaching is already there. the lectures are already there, and now it's just a question of connecting with an audience. And I strongly suspect we'll partner in some way, and I invite the audience to have a look. I will include the link to your online offerings in this podcast write up, and so folks can have a look and enjoy some fascinating content. I'll probably be diving in to a few things myself, and maybe circle back in subsequent podcasts in terms of the content therein. Nick, I know that you had a relatively limited time this morning. Is there anything else you wanted to say or touch on?
I mean, you mentioned my own background, which is very much shaped, I think, the way I approach it. And you said democratization, which really resonated with me. It's exactly right. I want to break through that pomposity and that exclusiveness, which is very often connected to economic status as well as intellectual status, and move beyond that. And this should be available to everybody, regardless of ability to pay. And I suppose that goes back to my own background. I've never, I was never one of the posh kids who went to a fee-paying school like so many Oxford tutors did. And I didn't go to Oxford. I went to Bristol and Birmingham University. And a lot of my friends aren't particularly academics. They're just normal run-of-the-mill people, and I just wanted to never I don't like that exclusivity, that we're the kind of in club and we're the ones who know and they're all outsiders. It's not like that. This is for everybody, and everybody's welcome in, and come on in and break down the walls if you like. And it's a bit like the a bit like the French Revolution, when all the people were strolling around the Louvre Palace admiring all the goods that were now their property. So maybe I should take that back, actually. It's a bit too, but something along those lines, that this is for everybody. It's not just for a small, privileged intellectual elite. I really want to get it out there and share what we have with everybody else. That's always the aim.
So shall we use the metaphor Prometheus then?
You'll have to explain it to me.
Prometheus stole the fire from the gods, from the Greek pantheon, to bring it down to earth so mankind can benefit.
Stick with the French Revolution.
All right, a revolutionary. All right, you'll have no argument from me. That's wonderful. It's been great having you on the program. I'll sign off, and then you'll just stay on for a second. So, okay. For those of you listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Nicholas Sutton, the director and clearly the visionary behind the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, in particular its continuing studies outreach, whose aim is to democratize knowledge, a great fruit of which seems to be these fascinating online courses. So check out the courses, check out the center, and until next time, keep reading, keep thinking, stay safe.